So hello, everyone. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you're beaming in from. My name's Rita McGrath. You probably knew that if you're logging in here. A couple of housekeeping things to remember. This is being recorded, and the recording will be available in a few days on YouTube. And my guest this week is Maura Ahrens-Mealy, who is author of a brand new book coming out April 11th called The Anxious Achiever. She also hosts the Anxious Achiever podcast on LinkedIn. And as she told me before, she's a recovering political consultant. So Maura, welcome, welcome, welcome.
Thanks, Rita. It's such an honor to be here with you.
Oh, it's a pleasure. So I loved your book. I thought it was just such an interesting read. I was lucky enough to get a sneak peek because the actual book doesn't come out till next month. But what I, oh, there you go. All right. I have the printed version. I thought that I would bring that with me, but then I thought looking at a big stack of papers is probably not all that interesting. The contents are super interesting, but the actual printed book, probably not so much. So let's just give us like the high level overview of what you cover.
Thank you. And thanks for the kind words. I love this book. I know authors always love their books. You know, as you know, they're like our babies.
Absolutely.
I love this book. And I wrote this book because as I was on book tour for my first book, which was called Hiding in the Bathroom, How to Get Out There When You'd Rather Stay Home.
Awesome title, by the way. That is like one of the best book titles ever.
Thank you.
I posted about it on social and everybody like retweeted and copied and clapped it. It was great.
Well, I think a lot of us, especially before the pandemic, when we used to go to a lot more conferences, would hide in the bathroom during conferences to get away from people. And I talked in that book about my anxiety. I had a chapter called The Gift of Anxiety. And when I went around talking to people, I found out that's what they wanted to talk about. Mm-hmm. They wanted to talk about how the anxiety that they traveled with also motivated them. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And yet sometimes that anxiety was just absolutely miserable to live with. Mm-hmm. And it was such a complicated and thorny thing. They felt that their anxious achievement was part of their identity and credited it to their success in many ways, but also that it had a real toll on their mental health, their joy, their relationships. And I just found this fascinating. You know, as an author or a thinker, you sort of have these aha moments and you're like, that's what I want to pursue. And so I did. And the book really covers what it's like to manage moderate anxiety, not clinical anxiety that's, you know, having you check into the ER with panic attacks and all that, although I have been through that and happy to talk about that. But the anxiety that's noticeable, that when you show up at work, you feel, that when you look at the headlines these days, you feel worry about the future, uncertainty, feelings of, am I good enough? Mm-hmm. Negative self-talk, perfectionism, imposter syndrome, right? Mm-hmm. Catastrophizing, all of these anxious habits and behaviors and thoughts that so many of us have. Mm-hmm. Right? How to manage through those, how to understand them, use them as data, and yet also how to sort of live with your anxiety as almost a partner that sometimes you have to tell to like buzz off, go away. And sometimes you're like, okay, let's use this.
Well, you know, what it made me think of in a strange way was that Disney movie Inside Out.
Yes.
Where they talk about the role of different emotions, you know, that sadness actually has a huge role to play in our ability to see joy, in our ability to make progress. And I thought that was one of the most interesting things about that movie, that, you know, we used to think of Disney princesses, right? And everybody's happy and everybody lives happily ever after and all the children are above average and so forth and so on. But that's not really the way the world works. One of the more interesting things I thought that really struck me in the book, that anxiety is actually a signal, like it's a warning system. And I thought that was interesting because, you know, if you think about it, pain is a warning system that helps you avoid, you know, you touch something hot and you pull away, right? And I guess mentally anxiety serves something of that same purpose.
Physically, actually, too, right? I mean, anxiety lives in our lizard brains and it's an emotion that evolved to keep us alive, right? Because anxiety is about feeling that threat response when you're scared of something, when something feels worrisome, right? And so that kept us alive on the plains when we were going to be attacked all the time. Unfortunately, we still get that threat response when we're heading to that 4 p.m. meeting with Bill and we're worried Bill's going to give us bad news, right? Our brain, I mean, one of the really interesting things I've learned in all my research is, you know, our poor brain, it hasn't caught up and it gives us anxiety for a reason. And one of the things that I argue is that our anxiety is there to give us data. And this is an emerging field of scholarship, right? It's really it's a counterpoint to the prevailing view of many past decades that anxiety is terrible. It's bad for our leadership, bad for our risk taking. It's bad for all that stuff. I think now what we're saying is anxiety, yeah, it can be bad. It can be debilitating, but it can actually be helpful. Mm-hmm. And it's a really important emotion for leaders to get in touch with. You know, we're really scared of emotions in our culture, especially in work culture, but you cannot be a leader or someone who is trying new things, taking risks, innovating without feeling anxiety. You just can't. Mm-hmm.
Well, and I think one of the dysfunctional things I see in the companies I work with, and my area, of course, is innovation and the intersection of innovation and strategy. And the extent people will go to avoid anything even moderately risky. I mean, I was talking to a guy at a company which is actually pretty well regarded for innovation, and he said to me, there are no lengths to which a person that works at this company will go to avoid even the smallest amount of risk. And I thought that was interesting, right? Because, you know, if you go into it with that mindset, you're never going to discover the next thing. You're never going to have the courage to take some kind of decisive action because you're just paralyzed.
100% Rita. And this is a big piece of the book, right? And part of it is that, you know, a lot of us carry around anxiety and the negative self-talk and thoughts that accompany it because we're afraid. We're afraid of being shamed. We're afraid of losing everything we've worked so hard for. Mm-hmm. Right? We're so anxious that people are going to find us out. Yeah. And when you're so anxious about that, mm-hmm. you can't innovate. Mm-hmm. Right? You can't take risks. And I want to read a quote of yours. I always like, I'm a big nerd. I like to do my research. And you wrote recently that think of the way we train and develop leaders. We don't generally train them in the skills of innovation or transformation. And it's an experience many have never encountered personally. Mm-hmm. They are thus left poorly equipped to lead efforts involving major uncertainties and change.
That's true. That's true. Well, the way I always think of it is if you think of a competitive advantage, you know, or something that you're making money from, I'm getting old enough now. I'm starting to wonder if competitive advantage is even the right term, but that's a whole nother conversation. But
that's, you know, above my pay grade.
Sorry, what?
That's above my pay grade.
But you think about it, it has a life cycle, right? Which is in the beginning, there's nothing. And there's this sort of soup of ideas and concepts and technologies and stuff, you know, and what is ChatGPT anyway? And, you know, and then out of that is the innovation process, the entrepreneurial process, which kind of gets to the point where something's ready to be taken to market. When you finally sorted out what it is you're actually doing, then you have a launch phase, right? Then you get this period of relative stability for a while, which people love. You know, it's like tomorrow's like yesterday and the day after that's like tomorrow. And, you know, you kind of can predict. And then in open markets, you know, a technological innovation comes along or a competitor does something or whatever. And whatever you built now becomes less relevant. And that's when you need to really transform your organization to a new way of being. And so 2/3, if you think of it as evenly distributed, 2/3 of your life, you're going to be spending either doing something that's new or changing something that's existing. And both of those involve massive amounts of uncertainty.
Right. And we get anxious when there's uncertainty.
Oh, yeah.
We don't like it. And so that's why you have to, as a leader or an innovator or creator or whatever, you have to be a little bit comfortable with anxiety. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so many of us, and it's not our faults, we're just used to shoving it away or drinking or, you know, whatever, watching Netflix or clicking on Instagram ads to stamp it down.
Uh-huh. So can you walk us through... So I've seen the light. My anxious friend over here is someone I'm getting more comfortable with. Where do I start? What do I do?
I would say, and I'm not a psychologist, I want to say this book is the product of many hours and hundreds of interviews, but
you have a ton of people on your podcast. Let me just reinforce, fascinating podcast where people really do open up about some pretty interesting and personal things, which is wonderful.
You know, the most important point, and again, it sounds so easy. All this stuff sounds so easy, is to notice when you're anxious. And, you know, every school of therapy, this is what they're going to tell you, because again, our brains developed anxiety and our brains want us not to feel anxiety. So when we feel that uncomfortable feeling, our brain either feeds us a thought, which is I'm terrible. So I have to work really, really hard because I'm terrible, or I'm going to worry, or I'm going to just use a coping mechanism, you know, and sometimes that's a great thing. I might go running, I might get exercise. And sometimes that is, if you're me, like having a shot of vodka and watching a lot of Netflix. And so, you know, or how we act out anxiety in the workplace is through micromanaging. It's through controlling behaviors, it's through gatekeeping, it's through perfectionism, all the things that drive people off the wall and we don't want to be. And so when you notice what is making you anxious and how you want to react, where your brain goes, that's really the first step.
So not just wallowing in it, kind of saying, Oh, isn't that interesting? I am feeling anxious right now. Why is that?
Right. And if you want to wallow, that's a valid choice. I mean, I'm not going to judge you for wallowing. If you want to say, I'm so anxious right now, this project is really, really bringing up all of my deep-seated fears and anxieties, I just am going to go watch Netflix for an hour. I'm not going to judge you for that. That's taking care of yourself. Okay.
Yeah. And I think that's also true, that we don't even almost have a language for talking about it. And, you know, one of the interesting things it raises for me, and I'm doing some research now on what I call the permissionless organization, which is organizations in which there's enough tech to do what managers used to do, but the tech has to be very well developed and it's got to be integrated, as our buddy Tiffany Bova would say. But then managers have to give up control. And for a lot of them, that is incredibly anxiety provoking. And so it comes together with a lot of narcissism. And, you know, there's all this research right now on workplace toxicity and, you know, what makes a place a great place or conversely an awful place to work. And I wonder how much of that is just the narcissist saying, oh, you know, it all has to be perfect and I have to control everything. And if I am not the one doing this, things will totally fall apart. And not trusting people to do the right thing in the right way, you know, given a certain amount of guidance. You know? And so I think it really plays into kind of as you move up a hierarchy and you don't figure out how to master this, it can really create big negative consequences.
It really can. It really can. And of course, all the work on psychological safety shows that it's when you sort of can step back and ask good questions and build an environment where people are feeling like they won't be shamed and punished if they take the wrong step. You know, and I have empathy for people at work who feel this way. We live in terrifying times. Everything's uncertain. Your job does not feel certain. So of course you're anxious. Of course you're tempted to take control. Of course you're tempted to do everything you can to just make everything good. That's of course. But at what toll to yourself and the people around you?
So one of the interesting things I think that comes out of both your work and the work that's been done on imposter syndrome and related sort of issues is that it actually can be a spur to incredible achievement, which, you know, you say in the title. Can you talk about that mechanism? It's sort of like, I this makes me anxious, so I've got to be super prepared and super forward thinking and all that.
Yeah. I mean, you know, anxiety fills us with what Dr. Wendy Suzuki calls activation energy, right? I mean, we go into sort of, if we're very anxious, fight or flight mode, right? We have a lot of hormones and chemicals rushing in. And so anxiety can be very productive, right? I think the classic example is before you give a talk or you're about to lead a meeting or something that feels like you have an emotional investment in it and it feels a bit high stakes, you're going to feel anxious in your body and your mind. And that's okay. That's good because you don't want to walk out there at the sort of like mellow level, right? You want to push through. And for me right now, like in my book launch phase, I'm so anxious, Rita. I'm so anxious. Is the book going to be good? Are people going to like it? Is it going to sell? All the questions, right? Uh-huh. And I have just said to myself, like, you're going to use this. You are going to work so hard. You're going to make tons of lists. You're going to have plans. You are going to have a plan for the worst case scenario. And that's okay. It's time limited. So I think what people who are really skilled at using their anxiety and who understand their emotions can do is sort of step back and get a little bit of distance from the emotion and say, are you serving me right now? Are you not? And be a bit more mindful about that question. Mm-hmm. It's really hard to do, but when you get good at it, it can be incredibly, incredibly fulfilling.
Are there particular sort of moments or turning points that you've observed that people have that allows them to do that, like that allows them to get ahead of that anxiety and perhaps put it to better use?
It's interesting. I've never seen research. I mean, I think that a lot of us, and there's a lot of leadership scholarship on this, you know, we're sort of, as Nancy Kane says, forged through crisis, you know, and I think that it's like any story of building resiliency. When you face a challenge in your life, you have a choice. You can do work and integrate the impact of that into your identity, into your personal narrative, into your story, or you cannot. Mm-hmm. Again, sounds easy, really hard to do. And I think,
like losing weight, right?
Exactly.
How hard is that?
But I feel like the people who commit, and this is why I think everyone should have therapists, and I think every leader should have a therapist, is that when you do that work, you are able to integrate what the challenge taught you, what it meant for you, how you can empathize with other people into your leadership and your story going forward.
So one of our listeners, Michelle Paddock, is asking, do you have a go-to practice to realize anxiety is affecting you? Sometimes I don't realize that's what's going on until someone I love asks me how I'm doing.
Exactly. You start to cry. That's a great question. You know, I have a lot of them at this point in my toolkit, but I find that I have to tune into my body. And I think everyone has a physical reaction to anxiety that's different, but some common ones might be that you find your heart is beating really fast. You feel a little bit jumpy. You might be having trouble focusing or concentrating. You might feel a bit nauseous. You might, you know, be clenching in your muscles.
This sounds like fun.
It's not fun. It's not fun. And the physiological reactions are very similar to stress and fear, but that's a tell. That is your body saying, Hey, pay attention to me. One of the stories I tell in the book, it's a personal story, is that I had migraines and nausea every Thursday morning and Wednesday night for years. And it was because, and this was again, through a lot of work at therapy, that when I was in high school, I was student body president, and that was our Thursday student body meeting, and they were torture for me. And then when I was in my early career, I had a Thursday staff meeting that I also was very gripped with imposter syndrome and a ton of anxiety about. And so I had really, like, if I had a meeting on Thursday, I had a physiological reaction to the anxiety. Mm. And this was an old pattern that wasn't serving me. That sounds kind of woo-woo, but think about it. Think about the time when you see that person's email in your inbox and you just jump and get nauseous. We've all had that feeling.
Oh, absolutely.
That's anxiety. Absolutely.
That's really interesting. So, but you do talk about it giving you energy, right? Acting as a warning, giving you a way of being more alert, right? I mean, and, you know, Andy Grove years and years ago talked about only the paranoid survive. And I think this is what he was getting at, which is if you don't have any anxiety, if like kumbaya, you know, Hakuna Matata, everything's good, you are so at risk, right? Because something's going to come along. I mean, there's always something. And I guess what anxiety leads to is the need to pay attention, the need not to become complacent, you know, because if you think about the flip side, right? Oh, I'm good. Life is terrific. There's nothing at all to worry about. No problems on the horizon, nothing. I mean, we have a lot of negative words for that too, right?
We have a ton of negative words, but I mean, that's against this knife's edge, right? Because you do want to be at a place where you're alert to the future. And certainly as a leader, you are paid to be alert to the future and think about all the case scenarios, and anxious people are good at that. Mm-hmm. But you don't want to be at a point where you're assuming catastrophe all the time, or you instantly go to a place of deep negativity, because anxious people are also really good at that too. Mm. And so it's a complicated dance, you know, and I have certainly been at points in my life, and I'm very open about this in the book. I have a bipolar 2 diagnosis. I have extreme anxiety, and I also have major depressive episodes, which is what makes me sort of bipolar, right? I can be up or I can be very, very down. Mm-hmm. You know, have had moments where anxiety just stopped me in my tracks and I couldn't leave my room. Mm. And I never want people to think that I'm sugarcoating it, but I do want to really stress the fact that it's part of life. It's a natural emotion, mm-hmm. and it's data.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So if you're in a group at work or in a situation where you're dealing with other people, how can you be helpful to someone who you think is anxious in a not positive way? Like, is there feedback you can give them? Are there specific supports? Are there specific tactics you can use?
I mean, I think the honest answer is to just be human, mm-hmm. and don't do it in a group setting, obviously. Mm-hmm. But if you can pull that person aside or catch up with them, or even just Slack them and just be like, "You okay?" Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that so much of this good leadership that is mentally healthy is just also very basic, and what we want people to learn in business school about being good leaders and good managers. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Ask questions, tune into people, mm-hmm. check in with them, make sure they are seen.
Which is so different than a lot of what you read about in like leadership textbooks, right? Where, you know, it's some guy on a horse waving a sword saying, follow me, follow me. And Thomas Tamiro from Music makes this point, which is, as again, this is a lizard brain thing, right? It's like, you know, if there is a saber-toothed tiger and it's about to jump at you, you want the guy who's going to say, follow me, I'll get us out of here. But what happens is we don't have those things in daily life so much anymore. And we tend to confuse competence with confidence. And I think that's where, again, our lizard brains just do us a disservice, because today, you know, we're dealing with knowledge work, we're dealing with intangibles, we're dealing with, you know, the big thing that's going to cause us anxiety is not something going to come along and eat us for most of us, but it's, you know, it's the boss is doing my annual review next week, or I've got to submit this thing to my publisher by tomorrow, or, you know, whatever it is. And that's where I think the competence needs to be shown, rather than just, oh, I got this, you know, and so, totally. So we mess that up. Yeah, right.
I mean, I think what I would like in the corollary to that is for the leader to say, follow me. But before that, to say, I'm not sure where we're going and I can't promise you this is going to be great, but I think I have a path. Let's go. Let's try it. You know, I mean, I think that, right. And there's so much data about this that we have to be not vulnerable in today's environment feels incredibly weird and inhuman. Mm. One of my favorite examples of vulnerable leadership in the book is from a senior HR person in a multinational company at the beginning of the pandemic. You know, when everyone was saying, what does this mean? Am I going to lose my job? What does that? And she said, she called everyone together and she said, look, I no more know the outcome of the pandemic than you do. I don't have a crystal ball. I can't tell you where we're going to be in 3 months or 6 months, mm-hmm. but I have a plan. Let's hold space in this half hour and see what we can do. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know,
Yeah, one of the things that I've observed is something leaders don't realize they have to do. And I think it does relate to this issue of anxiety, which is you have to lift the uncertainty from people's shoulders. You know, if you're in a position of leadership, that's a huge part of what that is. And a story that sort of makes this come to life for me is I was working with a group trying to do a new thing, an innovation in an insurance company. And in the United States, insurance is regulated by the states. So 50 states get to decide whether this thing can be offered in their state. And so the project manager, who is the leader in this case, is talking to the operations guy and saying, you know, are you ready? Like launches October 1st or whatever it was. Are you ready? And the operations guy's like, I don't know. Maybe I'm not. Like every physical sensation you described is like clearly what this guy is going through, right? I mean, he's sort of squirming up in his thing. His face is all wrinkled up. He's like, just really just like anxious, right? And I never made that connection between this story and anxiety before, but that's, I'll have to put that in my toolkit. But anyway, so the project manager's like, well, why can't I get an answer? So I kind of, in a moment, I sort of took him aside and I said, well, why don't you tell him how many states he needs to be ready for? And the project manager says, well, I don't know. I said, well, yeah, but neither does he. And you're in a better position to be wrong than he is. So he says, well, all right, whatever I'm doing isn't working. So we go back in the room and he says to the operations guy, what if I told you I expect us to have 15 state approvals on launch day? Do you think you could tell me whether you're ready? The change was electric. I mean, within 2 seconds, he had the whole plan laid out. He had all the staffing he needed. He had the levels. I could even do maybe 17. I mean, it was just what was fascinating to me about this, Maura, is no fact changed. There was nothing different about the situation. There was no new data. There was no test that had been done or experiment that had been run. All that had happened was the senior leader had taken that uncertainty, that anxiety off these people's shoulders. And this is something I advise, you know, when you're dealing with massive amounts of uncertainty, your job is not to be right. And this is, I think, something that people don't understand. Like, it's like we're brainwashed at school or something about getting the right answer. Guess what? You can't. And for a lot of people, that's really uncomfortable. So you have to come up with ways of lifting that anxiety and say, okay, just for today, here are the assumptions we're going to make about the state of the world. Here's what we think about the next step. Here's where we're going to go. And we're going to get to this point, and then we're going to stop and rethink what we're doing.
That is the best example I've heard of a point that is so important. And any parent knows this too. Anxiety loves a vacuum. And when you leave a vacuum in communications, anxiety rushes in. Mm-hmm. And so what your example shows is that the project manager had left a vacuum in the communication, leaving the employee to feel extremely anxious. And when he gave a clear deliverable and close that vacuum, anxiety lessens.
Mm-hmm. Right? Oh, it disappeared. The guy was like, okay, now I know what we're going to do. Boom.
Everyone has a plan. Everyone. I mean, like the first thing they'll tell you in cognitive behavioral therapy is like, make a schedule. But that is a skill. It sounds so basic. It is so powerful.
Very interesting. So are there specific suggestions you have for leaders who, you know, okay, they've read your book or they've heard this podcast or they've seen what we're talking about and they want to do something. So be aware, right? To have a schedule, absorb some of that uncertainty. Are there other tips you want people to think about who are in a leadership role?
Yeah. I mean, I think the awareness piece is really key. And there's some study recently that said self-awareness is the number one leadership quality. I haven't had time to dig into it, but I'm excited about that. I think that self-awareness is key, and understanding how and why anxiety shows up for you specifically in your work context is very powerful. Working on how you react is also very powerful. You know, who knows in your example where the project manager, he was feeling very anxious too.
So maybe the whole reason he didn't want to specify how many states was he didn't want to be wrong.
Exactly.
He had this whole doom loop going on of everybody trying not to be wrong, which would result ultimately in everybody being wrong and the project not working, right? Because nobody's really ready.
Well, and here's the thing. If you're the kind of person who feels that you can never be wrong personally, that affects your self-worth, your status, everything that means something to you, that's a question you have to look at. Mm-hmm. Who said you can never be wrong? Mm-hmm. My mom said I could never be wrong. I'm still playing out the effects of that.
Really?
Yes. Huh. Yes.
That's a big challenge. My goodness.
So many of us carry those early experiences, those early patterns. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for me, it's through therapy that you uncover and you make the connections. Mm-hmm. Why am I the boss that can never be wrong?
You had your own company for quite a long time, as I understand it.
I did. I was always wrong. I sold the company a year and a half ago to do this work, which is terrifying and exciting. But I love leaders who can be wrong. I love leaders who can say also, I'm not the smartest person in the room. Mm-hmm. I don't know about you. Those are my favorite people to work for.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. But they're hard to find. They're very hard to find. And you know, what you get in the world of innovation anyway, is you get an awful lot of innovation theater, which is, you know, oh, we'll create a studio. We'll create a, you know, incubator. This is our accelerator program, right? And then they staff them with these people who have just this, I'm going to be right kind of mindset. And you know, this burbles on for 2 or 3 years. And then just as they're getting somewhere, there's a blow up in some other part of the company and everything gets shut down. You know, it's totally predictable. It's like, I've seen that movie 100 times. And the right kind of leader for innovation are the curious ones, you know, the ones that are like, oh, well, I assumed people would like green. It turns out that's not the case. So how do we feel about blue? But to do that, you have to be wrong in the right way, I guess is the way I would put it, right? Yeah. So how do you do an experiment where you've got two perfectly legitimate hypotheses? And how do you go and find out? And I actually think this whole kind of return to the office, maybe, maybe not, hybrid or whatever, I think we just don't know very much about it, you know, and we have all kinds of hypotheses that we have not yet put to the test. So there's one hypothesis about, oh, people just want to work at their own convenience. There's another hypothesis about, oh, you know, people want to save their time commuting. And another hypothesis about people are just lazy. We have no knowledge. Like we're making all these huge policy decisions completely fact-free.
100%. And I'll tell you, you know, in the emerging field of workplace mental health, what I'm mm-hmm. hearing from leaders is, I've given them every mental health program there is. They're so anxious, but I think they're just using it as an excuse. You know, there's a real sense of judgment that people mm-hmm. have. And again, I don't have data to back this up, but I've heard it enough times that now that times are scary and hard, all that mental health stuff we were doing during the pandemic might not be as relevant. And like, we all have to get back to work and be hardcore. And that makes me really nervous because it's not like mental health challenges are going away anytime soon.
No, not at all. And in fact, I think it's worse now because, mm-hmm. and this is again, fact-free, but I got a sense during, at least for a lot of us, we were kind of all in it together, you know, like everybody was sort of cooped up. Everybody had challenges of family and how do I deal with this stuff? And everybody had tech issues and, you know, and it was a humanizing, right? You know, you saw toddlers flying around in the background. You knew what everybody's dog's name was. So that part was kind of very humanizing. Then we unfortunately got into politicization of a public health issue, which I don't think is ever a particularly good idea. And we stopped being in the same boat together, right? And now we're kind of emerging from that. And I think people really don't know how to be, right? We were talking earlier about travel, right? So do I want to get on that plane and go to Singapore or not? You know, did the pandemic leave me with greater wisdom about what I'm spending my time on or not? And I think that people are asking a lot of those kinds of questions.
I agree. And one thing I think also people are asking rightly is, you know, were we in the same boat? We were in the same ocean, but... Mm-hmm. My boat was a lot more difficult. My boat was this, my boat, because of structural issues in our society. And so I think that we're in such a complex period right now. Mm-hmm. It's so complex that we all have to be a little bit humble and a little bit willing, I think, to be vulnerable mm-hmm. because we need each other. We just need each other more. Mm-hmm. That's something else we learned during the pandemic. Mm-hmm.
So when it comes to mental health at work, I know you've done a lot of thinking about this. A lot of talk, some programs, some more or less effective, still a lot of judgment, right? Mm-hmm. And especially, I was reading about a not-for-profit group that's really trying to help people who are addicted, like really substance addicted. And the leader of this group said something that was really interesting, that, you know, people hate addiction so much. Like there's this whole moral mm-hmm. envelope around addiction. And yet we don't ask, well, what are the root causes that would cause somebody? I mean, nobody wakes up in the morning and says, you know, I want to ensure a habit that's going to keep me broke, wreck my family, degrade my health, and ultimately lead me to an early grave. I mean, nobody makes a conscious decision to do that. So how do we begin to have more healthy conversations, I guess I would ask, about mental health?
I mean, that's the question. I think it has to come with leaders. It has to come from people with status. I had the sociologist Marianne Cooper on mm-hmm. My podcast a couple of weeks ago. She's from Stanford. And she said, you know, our society, especially in the workplace, is just mired in who has more status. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm not asking people who are on their way up, who are fighting every day, who don't have status in an organization, to bear the water on workplace mental health. That's not your job. Mm-hmm. I want to see the white guy on the horse talking about it. And okay. I saw a comment that someone said, we have to stop conflating vulnerability with weakness. Is that Michelle? Mm-hmm. And really that's part of it. And that is the work that only people with power can do.
Mm-hmm. That's really interesting because we know Jeff Pfeffer, and he's written a lot about power, and he has this great book called 7 Rules of Power. And among the 7 Rules of Power are, you don't show weakness. You use short words, you communicate power, you interrupt people, you break the rules, you just do all these things that, and again, I think it's back to our lizard brains. It's like, we're wired that way. And yet it's not fit for purpose for modern organizations. So I think that's a really interesting observation. You know, people always ask me, well, where do I start with innovation? You know, and as with anything human, I think you have to start with your own agenda. And so before I go meet with a company, I'll say, well, you know, send me what you guys talked about when you got together to talk about important stuff, like what was on your agenda. And I'll go through it, you know, and if innovation is not like somewhere in the top three, like you're not serious. And I think we're at that moment, perhaps with mental health, where it's like people kind of, they edge in their seats, they sort of squirm, they're not comfortable talking about it. And I think until we get comfortable talking about it, I think that's really problematic. You know, I thought it was an interesting example of Lenny Mendoca. Mm-hmm.
Lenny. Yeah.
So he was a former McKinsey guy, super, you know, just super gifted, super smart, very nice, super nice guy. But he had this very high pressure job working with, I think it was the city of San Francisco. It was a governmental agency.
It was the governor's office. Yeah.
Yeah, governor's office.
He was on my podcast state. 2 weeks ago, actually.
Oh, was he? Did he talk about his sort of brush with depression and mental illness? And he's one of the few people I've known that has that kind of status, who's been willing to be open about it.
Yeah, I'm going to chat this episode. And then Lenny's story is amazing. And I asked Lenny when I interviewed him, I said, Lenny, you know, you had a very stressful job, but you retired from McKinsey, you know, mm-hmm. your proving yourself days are over. If you were in your proving yourself days, mm-hmm. you know, if you were in your 30s, mm-hmm. would you have written articles about your hospitalization mm-hmm. for depression? And he said, I don't know if I could have. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know,
yeah, it's interesting. Well, and I think the other thing that is a reality in organizations, right, is there are people who are self-serving. You know, there are people who will take advantage of you. There are people who don't have your best interest at heart. And I mean, as cynical as that sounds, and I prefer not to work in organizations which are full of those kind of people, but there are there. Fair. So, you know, it's sort of like you have to balance like who you open up to at what stage, you know?
So 100%, I am not asking anyone to ever be messy, to cross boundaries. No. Mm-hmm. There was an episode, and actually my episode this week features a very, very powerful man in Hollywood. He's the vice chairman of NBC Universal's business affairs. He basically makes all the deals. He's very open about his mental health. Mm-hmm. And a psychologist the company works with, Dr. Emily Anhalt, and I recommend her highly. She talks about something called boundaried vulnerability. Mm. And this is really important. So what she means is, how do we connect with each other on a human level, right? Especially around uncomfortable feelings and uncertainty and all the things, mm-hmm. without giving that other person an emotional hangover or a sense that you told them too much, TMI. How do we strike that balance? And that's where I think workplace mental health needs to go. Mm-hmm. Because this is a hard topic to talk about. We're not trained in it, most of us. Mm-hmm. Maybe never grew up talking about it. It's vulnerable. And so, of course, we're not going to be great at it at first. No.
But there are things structurally that organizations can do. So I don't know if you know Tiffany Bova. She's the chief sales evangelist or something at Salesforce. And they have this fascinating thing. They call it a V2 mom, which stands for vision, values, methods, obstacles, and metrics. So it's on one page, and it's like your plan for what you're going to do. So what's my vision for how good this could be? What values am I going to adhere to while I'm pursuing it? What methods am I going to use to try to get there? What are the obstacles that are in my way, and how might I overcome them? And then finally, what measures will I use to know if I succeeded or not? And I'll get to the point of this in just a second. But so they do it at the top of the company, and there's this huge sort of the senior people sort of say, well, this is what we think it could be. And then there's this huge like digital discussion in the company about feedback. And she said it runs into the thousands of pages. And then they use AI to kind of sort it into chunks. And then eventually they settle on, okay, for now, this is what we're going to do. But then everybody else in the company does one. And one thing I thought was fascinating was when she first came to work there, she was telling me this story that somebody she didn't know had connected with her and said, we'd love to have a meeting. Well, I'll have a look at your V2 mom, and then we'll have our meeting. And you look at mine, and we'll have our discussion. And she said at first she was absolutely horrified. She said, well, you're going to look at my plan for my year? You know, and I thought, well, and then she said, yeah, and that's how they do things. And so it creates the space for a conversation. And so where it connects to me to the mental health piece is, so let's say you and I are working together and there's something you want from me, right? And I look at my V2 mom and I say, well, hang on, if I do that thing for you, what comes out of this? Like, where are the trade-offs? Yeah. And what I thought was so interesting about that, and it's a perfectly business-like document. This is not a woo-woo mental health kind of thing. But what I thought it created in a really interesting way was people to have conversations about trade-offs and connections and visibility into what are you trying to do, right? So I don't go charging off into your office thinking you've got all the time in the world to deal with my stuff. And it kind of creates the opportunity for a discussion. So I think even if you're not into, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy or you know, talking about feelings a lot, there are mechanisms you can put in place that naturally encourage sort of those conversations, I think.
I love that. And the other thing you mentioned was values. And I think that values are key to all of this. You know, our values are what keep us moving forward. And there is a school of therapy called acceptance and commitment therapy. And it's very values-based, because when you are anxious about something, sometimes you're tempted to not do it, to avoid, right? To do all the things that we do to not feel anxious. And when you can connect your emotions to your values, all of a sudden, you might be given courage and strength to push forward. And so I think that all of us, you know, whatever we define our values as, in a work and what we want from career context, that's powerful to know. Because when things get really hard, they can be something to tap into.
So you went from owning a business and having employees and all that kind of thing to really being like out on the high wire on your own now. How has that journey been for you?
Oh, wow, Rita. It's been scary because, you know, I think I'm 46. So I did this huge career shift when I was 45. And You know, I really felt lonely. I do. I still feel a bit lonely. I miss my team. I talk to them a lot, but I think that the freedom of reinvention is tough to do when you're in midlife and you have three kids. So I've just been trying to be a realist while also pursuing this period of reinvention, and it's exciting. But I think what I learned from my sale of my business is one of my hugest business values is a great team. Mm-hmm. Perhaps my number one, mm-hmm. being surrounded by a great team who I value and they value me. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We should all have that. That is my wish for everybody.
Yeah, there's a really interesting book about CEOs. And in the book, one of the points, I'm trying to remember who the author is. He used to write the corner office column for the New York Times.
But David Gelles?
Sorry?
David Gelles?
Yes. Another guy. But anyway, it doesn't matter. I'll dig his name up and we'll send it to you in the comments. But he makes the point that at any point in time, once you have a golden age of a team, it's never going to last more than 2 or 3 years. And I thought that was interesting because people grow out of their roles. They're not going to stay there forever. If they're really, really great, they're going to progress in some way. They're going to, you'll have people who haven't quite stepped up to the plate yet. You'll have people who are still developing into your roles. And I thought that was an interesting reflection to me that if you do get that, like, love it, because it's only here for a blip, and then things will change and people will move on.
That's so interesting. And of course it makes perfect sense. I think love it and learn from it, right?
Yeah.
Learn like what were those magical elements that made it feel like it all worked?
Yeah. Yeah. So with respect to organizations now, right? One of the things that's definitely happening, and it's happening for a lot of reasons, is we're seeing the bureaucracies flatten. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that happens well, and a lot of times it's happening very badly. And people, I think, are being asked to do two things that are really hard. One is, you know, in a traditional sort of corporate bureaucracy, you had a lot of trainer jobs. So, yeah. You know, you ran a city, and then you ran a state, and then you ran a region, and then you got sent off to, you know, Madagascar or something where you could run a country. But, it, you know, if you made a mistake, it didn't right. sort of damage the mothership, and then you came back home, and then blah, blah. And now all those kind of trainer experiences are not there anymore. So you're going from this level to this level without all those intervening chances to learn the job. And I just have got to think that creates enormous amounts of anxiety without the organization coming back and saying, okay, we're going to support you in doing that huge jump, right? Have you seen that too?
I think what I'm hearing from managers is my job has changed so much over the past 3 years. And now I am expected to be sort of a therapist of sorts. I'm going to tell you, that's not your job and that's not fair. And I'm being asked to be a subject matter expert and so good at all of this. And yet I don't know how to manage people. And my people are so complicated and they want all this stuff from me and they want me to be vulnerable. And I don't know how to do this. And what I've heard is that companies are not giving a lot of time to learn these kinds of skills, mm-hmm. whether they're communication skills, mental health, first aid, you know, all the training in that sense. Mm-hmm. Which I guess back in the day, you just sort of learned as you went through life, right? You just learned the hard way. But I think that companies, if what you're saying is true, they need to invest mm-hmm. in truly training the human, mm-hmm. not just training them to do the job.
I think that's where we're headed. I think that's where
you
we're
do.
Headed.
I'm worried it's going to get cut because of the economy, though.
Well, that's an interesting question, because what I'm seeing is kind of two reactions. One is the knee jerk, I don't know what the future holds, so I'm cutting back. Mm. The other is, we could be really vulnerable if we don't prepare ourselves now. So there is a camp out there, and one of my potential clients actually works in the mental health space, and she's a HR leader for it. And she said, you know, we're asking so much of our senior leaders. We need them to have resources at their disposal. And so whatever happens with the economy, she says, you know, if like I can offer them those resources and they can continue to function, or I cannot, and the outcome is going to be really bad. And I thought that was a really interesting perspective to take, you know, that she's really thinking ahead about, you know, yes, okay, it's an investment now, but it's a rounding error relative to the well-being of our senior team in the company.
It's true sustainability. Mm-hmm. And if we don't help our people become sustainable, mm-hmm. where are we going to be?
Exactly. So one of our commentators.
Yes, Chris.
Well-being is an investment, not a cost. Totally. Totally. Well, you know, the old line, right? Well, what if we train our people and they leave for the competition? And it's like, well, what if we don't train them and they stay? I mean, that's not a good thought. It's funny, you know, Peter Capelli from Wharton has a fascinating piece recently in the Harvard Business Review, looking at how accounting actually completely shifts how we think about building capability in our people, because we don't account for it as creating an asset. We account for it as being an expense.
Right.
And so if you were able to, let's say, treat investments in people the same way you could treat investments in R&D, or the same way you treated investments in constructing a building or something, where you've actually got an asset that you've created, you would account for it. You would probably behave very differently in how people were managed at work.
I love that. Love that. You know, and I think people invest in gyms. Companies get that. They invest, you know, I think the wonderful thing is that more and more companies are making sure they have a therapy benefit in place, you know, and this is for privileged workers. Mm-hmm. Sadly, although some companies are doing it for hourly workers, which I think is really important. So do you have great benefits, right? Do you have access to a telehealth, right? Mm-hmm. Service like a Lyra or a Headspace for Work or something like that. And, you know, that's, as my friend Kelly Greenwood says, that's table stakes.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that the harder work is that, you know, accruing for your mental health is seen as just as essential mm-hmm. as telling your employees, hey, we want you to exercise. So we have this lovely gym.
And daycare center on site. So you can work even more.
Well, that's a whole other thing.
Indeed.
Yes. I mean, I think the ultimate mental health cure would be for people to stop being so demanding, so, you know, boundary crossing, and to let people have space and time away from work. But
Well, you know, Whitney Johnson talks about this too, which is, and you're living this right now, right? And this is another interesting thing to me about anxiety, which is, so we're in that safe space. We've had no challenges. Things are just kind of, today's like tomorrow, tomorrow's like, and as humans, this weird thing happens, right? We start to feel anxious about not having something new to look forward to. We start to get bored, and then have the courage to take that leap and move to something new when you know you're going to be inexpert at first, and you know that it's not going to be easy, and you know you're on a learning curve that's going to be pretty steep. I mean, that kind of is the product of anxiety too, but that's how you grow, right?
Yes. And there's data showing that entrepreneurs, who are people who have to disrupt themselves or choose to disrupt themselves all the time, you know, tend to be more anxious, actually.
Really?
Yeah. Huh. Yeah.
But in a positive way.
No. In a really? Critical way. Yep. And tend to have more depression, tend to have more bipolar, tend to have more hypomania. And it's controversial, but it sort of makes a bit of sense when you think about how entrepreneurs are both driven by an anxious drive to mm-hmm. fill something that's missing mm-hmm. and also by maybe comfort with uncertainty and anxiety mm-hmm. and take risks.
Mm-hmm. Or a need to prove themselves.
Yes, 100%.
A lot of that. There's a lot of that going on. And it was interesting, the guy that kind of invented the hedge fund business, the private equity business, committed suicide. And I'm thinking to myself, the guy has every...
Who's that?
Thomas Lee.
Committed suicide?
In his office. You know, yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And so, you know, it's interesting to me because, and I don't know him or his family or anything. All I know is what Bloomberg reported on it. But their hypothesis was that there he was. He created this whole sector and he was trying to raise money. Apparently he had a long history of really bad relationships with team members, partners, according to this article, and then had trouble raising a fund and got overwhelmed by his own kind of comparison of what he, and the article said, again, I don't know any of this, this is not a fact, but the article speculated that it was his own self-comparison of what he had wanted to do with what actually was happening in his life that caused him to just go into this despair and then, you know, kill him. I mean, here's a guy, you know, technically you could not want more from life than having created a whole category, made billions, you know, you could feed the world. I mean, you know, the door would be open to pretty much anything you wanted to do. And yet, so fixated on that, right?
Mental illness doesn't discriminate. Mental illness doesn't. And actually, I did want to say something that I've learning in the field that the vernacular is changing from committing suicide to died by suicide.
Oh, uh-huh.
Because suicide isn't something that we commit to. It's a mental illness.
Mm.
And so committing makes it feels like we're, you know, committing a crime.
That's interesting.
Doing this, yeah.
Oh, that's
died by suicide. Yeah.
Suicide. I had not thought about that before. Thank you.
No, me neither, but there you
that's
go.
That's very, very interesting. So we have just a couple of minutes left, unfortunately. I'd love to get your perspective on what you would advise younger people. Like, so I take somebody who's like 25, let's say, and they've had three weird years. So they're kind of out of, young professionals are out of college. They've had three really weird years. They're looking sort of at what's coming. Are there any thoughts you might have for how they could be thinking about creating a fruitful path for themselves?
I think that becoming aware at a young age, I mean, it's hard when you're young, right? I think this is something that you have to grow into, mm-hmm. but I think investing in your self-awareness is valuable. Mm-hmm. And that could look like a lot of things. I mean, that could look like therapy. That could look like certain kinds of coaching. That could look like volunteering and getting perspective.
Mm-hmm.
I think really investing in both your own self-awareness and then other people's perspectives is very, very valuable. And you can get this in certain jobs, right? I mean, I always joke, I started out my career as an executive assistant to big executives. That was how I learned how people tick, how dynamics are created. I learned mm-hmm. everything. That was a job that taught me all this stuff. So mm-hmm. I can do that too.
Interesting. That's super interesting. So obviously the Anxious Achiever out April 11th. Woo, woo. I will be cheering on your launch. There you go. I love that. I have it on pre-order, but obviously it hasn't come yet. So definitely buy the book. Definitely tune into the podcast, Anxious Achiever Podcast on LinkedIn. Is there any other resource you would point people towards?
No, I would love to say if people have questions for me, please message me on LinkedIn. I will write back.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome. Well, Maura, what a pleasure. Enjoy St. Patrick's Day. I'm sure they'll be doing cool things at St. Patrick's Day in Boston. I'm in New York. We will, I'm due to head home to Princeton, New Jersey tonight because as my Irish husband likes to say, Patrick's Day is amateur hour.
That's very funny.
So that's what I'll be doing tonight.
No green mashed potatoes for you.
No green mashed potatoes for me.
Thank you so much, Rita.
Well, thank you so much for this and enjoy the weekend. Thanks, everybody.